Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this March 11th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. It is a pleasure to have you all here, and the all, of course, includes my committee colleagues. But particularly for those of you who are coming to speak to us about the issue of employment challenges for people with disabilities here in this state. We are going to be hearing a bill, Senate Bill 555, on that subject. But in order to create the proper background for us discussing that bill, we thought it would be good to have an informational hearing on disabilities and employment. And so that's what we'll start with. So I'm going to open this informational meeting on disabilities and employment. And we have several panels of people who have volunteered to come and speak to us. I'd like to start off, though, with Senator Gelzer, who, as many of you know, has a long experience and expertise in this subject. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelzer. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, Millersburg, Tangent, and unincorporated areas of Linn and Benton County. And Senator Knope's father is my constituent. So thank you so much for taking time to schedule a public hearing or an information session on the issue of employment of people with disabilities. This is an issue that's gaining a great deal of attention both statewide and across the country. One of the things that has changed in recent years is that we have a new generation of people that experience intellectual and developmental disabilities that are coming of age, and their expectations for their future is different than the expectations of those who have come of age in generations before. This is primarily because, fortunately, our culture and society has changed, and from the time individuals are born with disabilities, they are included in their families, they are included in school, they are included in their communities. So as they are leaving high school and going into the workforce, they expect to be treated as equal adults with all other adults in our communities, and that's absolutely appropriate. So that includes everything from deciding where people want to live, whether or not they want to get married, where they want to work, and that they would be entitled to the same rights as everyone else, the right to make their own decisions about their lives, and the right to be protected by the same wage and hour laws as everyone else. One of the issues that's the subject of great debate right now, again, both at the state and national level, is the issue of subminimum wage for people that experience disability. In the 1930s, Congress, at a very different time when laws were much more based on charity than empowerment, made it possible for people with disabilities to earn less than minimum wage under Section 14C. So organizations that have these 14C certificates are allowed to pay people less than minimum wage. The way that the wage is determined is that the individual does a productivity test. That person will do a task, and they will be compared to a person who has been in that job, I believe, for 2 years and working at their peak productivity. The percentage of that very high level of productivity is the percentage of the minimum wage that that individual would be paid. I would point out that any of us on any given day are probably not putting out over and over again at the peak productivity of a person that has been at the job for a period of time. It's also important to remember that when you're looking at employment, I'm not good at every job. There are some jobs that I'm good at, there are some jobs that I'm not going to be particularly good at, and so people ask me, I get to have some choice in terms of what job it is that I pursue and what training I've chosen for myself. And that's true for people with disabilities as well. In Oregon, a couple of things have happened recently as well. There was a class action lawsuit that was brought against the state of Oregon by individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, arguing that our state was disproportionately spending employment dollars on sheltered work and subminimum wage work, rather than providing people with the supports that they need to work in the community, to work in competitive workplaces alongside non-disabled people for competitive wages at or above the minimum wage. wage. As that worked its way through court, the federal court made a really important ruling for the state of Oregon and across the country. That ruling said that the Olmstead ruling, which has to do with desegregation and deinstitutionalization, that ruling from this federal court said that that principle applies to employment as well, and that a state cannot prioritize funding sheltered workshops and sheltered work over providing people with the skills and training that they need to compete in a general workplace. Around that same time, then Governor Kitzhaber issued an executive order to look at employment in the state of Oregon. The goal of that, and you'll hear from some of the great leaders of that program today, has been to better prepare adults that want to choose to live in the community. I just accidentally closed my page here. That want to work in the community. This has been really important to me because I'm the parent of one of the individuals that is directly impacted by this. My son has given me permission to talk about him, but his name is Sam. He's 20 years old, and thanks to the governor's executive order, he actually has access to vocational rehabilitation services. He is having the opportunity to have a skills assessment in the community and not in a sheltered workshop, and he is not going to be placed outside of his transition program directly into a sheltered workshop. I served for several years on an organization called the National Council on Disability, and in 2012, we did a study of 14C certificates and subminimum wage. My team traveled to 7 different states. We visited all sorts of sheltered workshops, supported employment. We met with individuals with disabilities, their families, and program workers, and we made a number of findings. One was that we do believe that people should be able to access the minimum wage, but a wholesale elimination of 14C certificates without that transition period isn't wise. There needs to be a period of transition to make sure that people have the support that they need to be successful. And so the NCD issued a series of recommendations in order to make that possible. And that's really what the governor's executive order does. It's looking at kids like my son coming in the front door, providing them with the training and supports they need to be able to work in the community. People that are older, that have been established in the workforce, will be able to make choices about where they want to stay and where it is that they want to go. But the goal is to support all people that are able to move into supported employment. The Government Accountability Office, and I've just shut my screen so now I can't access it, but found that individuals that go into sheltered workshops are extremely unlikely to ever leave. There is no research-based evidence that shows that sheltered workshops will build job skills for people or prepare them to move out into a competitive employment setting. We also know from research that individuals who are in supported employment, over time, the cost of supporting them in that employment and their goes down, their wages go up. People that are in sheltered workshops, over time, their costs go up and their wages stay down. The majority of individuals working in a sheltered workshop earn less than minimum wage. Colleagues, I would just close by saying, if we have a minimum wage, I believe that that should apply to all people, regardless of the color of our skin, regardless of where we were born, regardless of whether or not we experience an identified disability. It makes little sense to me that today, in 2015, we still point to a category of people and say, your day's work is worth less than my day's work. Your toil is worth less than my toil. You are worth less than I am. So we're going to put you in this hidden place. We're going to pay you less than everybody else. And that message that people get when that happens is that somehow they aren't equal, that they are less than, and that they aren't full members of our community. So thank you so much for holding this hearing. It really is a civil rights issue.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any quick questions of the senator? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, our next panel is Trina Lee, Lilia Tenenti, Mike Maley, and Mitch Kreska, if you can all squeeze in there. Okay, great, Mike. You could
Senator
introduce
Dimbrough,
yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Mike Maley. I'm the DHS, Department of Human Services, statewide coordinator of Employment First.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Lilia Tenenti. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services within the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough. My name is Trina Lee, and I am the Interim Director for Vocational Rehabilitation from the Department of Human Services.
Senator Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Kruska. I'm Director of Educational Programs, Secondary Transition, and Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you. Welcome, all of you.
And I will be leading off, and I think you all have the PowerPoint, and we'll be talking from that today. And the first slide here, every Oregonian can work to the best of their abilities to contribute to their community, their family, and their communities, I think is an important first slide, because when we're talking about employment first, as Senator Gelser was just discussing, it is both a philosophy and a policy. You know, the philosophy that everybody can work and contribute to their community regardless of the type or the severity of their disability. And we wanted to put that up there first, you know, because it is an underlying principle that all of our comments that you're going to hear from us is based on. So Employment First, is an initiative to assist individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities obtain, maintain, and succeed in jobs in their communities. And there is some history here. The department adopted an Employment First policy a few years back, and you see the framework there. Work in integrated jobs is the first and priority option for planning employment services for individuals. The key there is integrated jobs, and the kind of working definition of that are jobs that are typical to the businesses in somebody's community, you know, where they are working alongside people and peers and coworkers without disabilities. We do have the governor's executive order, which charges the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education to improve employment outcomes, you know, in that direction. Senator Gelser stated, this is not just specific to Oregon. This is a national initiative. And most states are engaged in some type of very visible, tangible employment first activity. I think the count is well over 40 states are engaged now in something where you can really say that is an employment first initiative. And this aligns with state and federal policies. 427-007, the state statute that you see on the screen, is the fundamental legislative policy and direction for services to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in this state. And that was modified a couple of years ago to really be updated to reflect the language of employment first as a priority activity that we're all directed to achieve. And many state agencies and federal agencies and regulations and other policies are now emerging around the same topic. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, which is a primary funder of services here in the state, has directed that all the services they pay for be going toward integrated employment for individuals. Certainly the Workforce and Innovation and Opportunity Act that was passed just a few months ago directs us in that direction. And other agencies, the Rehabilitation Services Administration, the Department of Labor at the federal level, all are aligning policies in this direction. So the efforts that we're in are not just specific to the state, but they are also reinforced at the federal level as well. So Employment First is really a focused planning effort at an individual level to help a person plan for the services that they think are in their best interest and consistent with their needs. It is it's a highly individualized process, and it's a strength-based process. So when they're out looking for jobs, there's really a good match between what they are really interested in and good at and what the employer may need. And it's really about opportunity. And we listed several points there, but if you go to the bottom couple, it's through employment where you really increase control and choices, you know, in your life. And that's really something that's very, very important to everyone, and that improvement of quality of life. And when you look at our collective jobs, there's lots of, mission and vision and other kinds of of formal statements, but when you really look fundamentally at what our collective job is, it's to help somebody build a life, you know, and build that life in the same terms that all of us in this room want to build a life. It's where do you want to work? How do you want to make your money? Where do you want to live? Who do you want to spend your time with? How do you want to spend your time? And employment is key to doing many of those things. The benefits of employment, as I'm sure you all know, but if you look at it, it's good for the person. And again, there's some bullet points up there, but certainly people will benefit from everything from the tangible to the intrinsic benefits of work. What you see below that is a couple of quotes. We collect success stories of people who are getting jobs in the community, and we have staff that go out and interview them and take some pictures, and we post those pictures on the website. And this is just a couple of quotes from a couple of the success stories that we've had, and I think the quotes really help drive home the importance of the work and the opportunity to work from that perspective. But the benefits extend beyond that, and this is an important slide because it's also good for business. And I think when we talk about employment first, we need to understand it's really a two-dimensional initiative, if you will. Certainly, it's mission and vision driven in terms of the impact it has for an individual and their family. But at the same time, it's good for our communities and the businesses in those communities. So it's really kind of a workforce and economic development strategy as much as it is a mission-driven strategy, and I think we get ourselves in a little bit of a trap if we only see this as a social service type of endeavor. It's bigger than that. And what you see in this slide, and I didn't quote the study in here, but businesses report these kinds of benefits, you know, by hiring individuals with disabilities, the benefits to their businesses. And what you see, the quotes at the bottom, our Oregon employers, based on these success stories, when we go out and talk to the employers, these are a couple of quotes that we get from them who says, this is, again, very important for our business and is value added from that perspective as well. And I think it just reinforces the kind of the dual importance of the initiative that we're talking about. At the very bottom there, I didn't, the Desert Lanes Family Fund Center, I just noticed I didn't quote where that was. That is in Hermiston. So again, the success stories that we are seeing are all over the state. From an implementation standpoint, this is, and from developmental disabilities, from VR, and from the Department of Education, this is a major systems change effort. There's a lot of effort, resources, and emotion going into this on a statewide basis. The bullet points below that are really the main strategies that we're employing. So if you look at some cornerstone strategies that we're trying to implement through this initiative, these are some of those. So first is both focusing on youth and working age adults. And working age adults, it includes those individuals who are in sheltered workshops and other facility-based services. But to be successful in the long run, we have to focus on both populations, including a lot of effort going into those individuals who are emerging into the workforce. But quite frankly, it also involves working with younger children and families so they have a vision of employment even prior to those later school years where we're talking about actually transition into adulthood. We need to increase the capacity of our providers and our whole system to do the nature of the work that's required here. We need to establish collaborative and complementary working arrangements among our partners. And I probably could have said that better, but really the point to all of this is we need to create partnerships where there is co-ownership of the desired outcome. And I think you'll hear that from the presentations, you know, after me. We have to not just play fair together. We have to understand that we have to, that we depend on each other for the success and own that success. And conducting outreach, awareness, and education activities is another major part of the activities that we're engaged in. So what a success looks like, We've increased the number of people who have actually got work in integrated jobs. We're providing more services related to employment to individuals in our service system. And we are in particular, and I think this is a an indicator of success and more desire and focus toward getting integrated employment, we're seeing a lot more referrals to the vocational rehabilitation services, which is really the gateway to actually the acquisition of jobs in our communities. So we can't let this go without some stories. So in terms of youth and school transition, this is Bonnie. She went right from leaving school into a job. And again, there's just all sorts of storylines here. But I thought it was just very cool that she said in her interview, man, I got a tip for doing a good job. So I thought that was pretty cool. This is Jerry, who prior to the job you see talked about here, was in a sheltered workshop. He now works at the Wild Horse Resort and Casino in Pendleton. And the quote that struck me when we were talking to him is, what I really like is getting to talk to and meet so many different people. That's very telling, I think, from a success standpoint. When we met with Senator Dimbrough about this presentation, he asked that we do talk a little bit about the challenges that we face. And here are a few. The first one I put on here is history. Senator Gelser said this much more eloquently than I can, but when you just look back over the years, there was not necessarily an expectation of work or a belief that work could be possible. So not everybody that we are engaged with in the systems change effort is of the same belief system. And so when we talk about systems change, we always talk about it in two dimensions. One is you got to change policies and practice, but many ways you have to change belief systems, you know, as well. So we have efforts going on in both of those areas. The pace of change, we are making our changes very rapidly in many dots that need to be connected. And I think that puts a particular stress on our service delivery system. So we are changing quickly, and we still have things in today's world that need to be done. There are federal issues and drivers. There are some new federal laws and policies. You'll hear a little bit about that from Lilia and Trina. We also have the federal court litigation that is out there as well. But one of the big ones, and one of the ones we hear most consistently, is service provider capacity. To be successful, we're asking providers to acquire new skills, to transform some of their business models, and we need more providers. So a lot of effort is going into that transformation of a service provider structure and skill set so we can move in this direction in terms of the acquisition of integrated jobs for individuals and the prioritization of work. The Employment First Initiative is not the only thing that VR and ODDS and the Department of Education and all the local partners are asked to do. There are other things going on at the same time that are of high priority, so there's this constant competition for time and attention to move forward. So that's one of the areas we've got to continually try to navigate. And of course, we can't do this without state and local partners, and there's many, many, many. But at the state level, those agencies charged most directly with implementing the Employment First Agenda are the Office of Developmental Disability Services, Vocational Rehabilitation, and the Department of Education and their respective local partners in doing that. But we also wanted to add, in terms of the charge of this committee, we need to continue to work also in scooping in the workforce and economic development systems with this, and how we maintain our involvement with the larger efforts on a statewide basis, and how we can partner better, coordinate better, and be a part of those larger that larger movement. So we really want to have the discussions and work with the agencies that are necessary to make that agenda happen, so we can join not just the world that we live in every day, but in terms of the broader systems change movements that, that are taking place in the workforce system. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lilia, and then we can, if there are questions, we'll take those at the end.
Thank you. Again, my name is Lilia Tenenti. I'm with Office of Developmental Disability Services within DHS. Today, I'm here to talk to you about the Employment First Initiative in the context of the Office of Developmental Disability Services and how we're working with our partner agencies and with local communities to move this initiative forward. Our commitment to those we serve is really focused on core values that were established in Senate Bill 22. You can see here they speak to choice and self-determination, integration in community settings, services that are consistent with choice. Individuals and advocates, we want them to play a major role in their services, and we really are looking at how we do integration, independence, and productivity in a way that is meaningful to the people that we support. All of these core values were developed in the broader context of all of the services provided and supports provided by the Office of Developmental Disabilities, from residential services and supports to transportation to and really thinking about employment and now and how these values also apply to our employment services. So these are values that are consistent with the goals of our employment initiatives as well as all the other types of services we provide. ODDS serves, at this point, over 22,000 people in the state of Oregon who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities. Some examples include those individuals with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, autism spectrum disorders, acquired brain injury, and, of course, children who are have drug-affected children. The people that we serve generally have, this is going to be a lifelong issue. The diagnosis needs to occur before the age of 18 or 21 in some instances for people to receive services through ODDS. As you think about that and consider that, basically what that does mean is our service system provides lifelong supports. We have many, as a result of the Community First Choice or K-Plan option, we've got many children now coming into services through ODDS, and we expect that we're going to be supporting these children through their lifespan, as well as the many adults that are already in our system. And this is why, in thinking about overall the services provided through the Office of Developmental Disability Services and sustainability and goals that we have for ourselves, this is one of the ways in which employment and embedding the idea of integrated, competitively paid employment into our system and supporting that for the people we serve is so important, is because we see that this is going to be something that improves the someone's life over the lifespan, but also really creates opportunities for them to be more fully integrated in their communities, ultimately from our perspective with the goal of getting the appropriate supports through a Medicaid-funded system, but not completely relying on it if we get to that point for individuals who are able to be who are able to access integrated supports, integrated employment supports. Some of the types of services that we provide through ODDS are case management services, as I mentioned, residential supports, foster care and group homes, in-home services, supports to families, both families with children living at home with intellectual and developmental disabilities and families who have adults with children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In the IDD service systems, generally a significant portion of the population of adults live at home with families, more so than you see potentially in other types of service arenas. And so this is something that's important as we support those families, and we also support the adults that are living with them. I mentioned transportation. That's one of the services we provide. And then, of course, all of our employment-related activities and services. These services in general really focus on the goal, as we've said, from our perspective of getting people in integrated employment opportunities in their community. We do that through a service called Individual Supported Employment. We use a service called Discovery to really help people identify what jobs they might like or might like to think about, learn more about them, and then try to help them through the process as they discover themselves and think about employment, what might be appropriate for them. when we talk about the philosophy or the idea that people with disabilities and intellectual and developmental disabilities specifically can be employed, a lot of times we're talking to people who have never really considered that a possibility for themselves, nor have their families considered that a possibility for them. And so part of our work is really to help change that idea and help people understand what is possible so that they can move forward in that direction. We also provide job development services, small group supported services, and employment path services. So these are an array of employment services that we now provide, ultimately each of them with a goal of helping someone get a job in an integrated setting in their community. Employment path is the service that is currently used to fund those supports that we more traditionally have associated with sheltered workshops or group settings where it's just people with developmental disabilities working, and we've put a lot of work into how we can use that service to appropriately help people move forward in the transition to integrated employment. As Senator Gelser mentioned, in terms of, you know, the idea that it's not just the job there at the end of the day, it is ultimately a path to, we want it to be a path to employment, and which is consistent with our goal for Oregon and also consistent with direction we've gotten from CMS. Priorities and challenges in this initiative. Implementing new federal regulations, recently CMS came out with home and community-based settings rules and regulations, and we're moving forward with those implementing those regulations and working with our provider communities and our stakeholder communities on how that process will roll out. Those regulations apply to all services funded in the home and community-based service settings from CMS, but it really is one of the pieces that we are using to really look at day service and our employment service settings is how do we align ourselves appropriately with these new guidelines from CMS so that we can assure continued Medicaid funding for these programs now and well into the future. One of the big challenges that Mike mentioned, appropriately so, is service provider capacity. We've built a system over a number of years for all the good and right reasons that really support a certain type of service. And at this point, we're shifting in a new direction. And so in doing so, we need to revise and relook at how our provider capacity, our provider community, and really support the effort to transition so we can offer more services to people to successfully identify, find, gain, and maintain services in their local, employment and jobs in their local communities. Our capacity around this area ties to case management services and to our direct service providers who do the integrated employment. We also have an increasing number of referrals that are coming into our system. I mentioned children and adults, transition age youth are looking at employment. We're looking at employment services in the transition process with ODE and with VR, and what our engagement and involvement in that is, in that particular perspective is, and that's, you know, definitely something that we have in mind and continues to be brought to the forefront in terms of capacity and the number of people that we're serving and having the right systems and supports in place to achieve our goals of integrated employment. One thing that I'm just going to speak to that isn't specifically on this slide in terms of a challenge is really working with the local communities, as we've done in a number of ways, and really pushing the idea or helping people understand what is possible for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. There was a time when we didn't think that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities could live in their local communities. We know that is absolutely now possible, and it is in Oregon the expectation. And I think as I think about helping people achieve integrated employment, it follows along the same path. We are working to move it forward in such a way that we understand in the future that this is the expectation, and it's something we know everyone can achieve, and it's something we want everyone to achieve. So this is information from the Office of Developmental Disability Services and our work on this important initiative, and at this point, I will turn it over to Trina.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee, again, my name is Trina Lee, and I am the Interim Director for Vocational Rehabilitation. And I'm going to have Mike drive the Do I have the PowerPoint? Thank you for that. I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce you to what we do at Vocational Rehabilitation and how it impacts the lives of individuals with disabilities across Oregon. So starting out with our mission for our program is exactly that, where we assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve and maintain employment and independence. Moving on, I know the slide's a little busy, but it shows you a lot of information. First and foremost, I think it's important that I indicate the number of Oregonians that we were able to serve in federal fiscal year 14 was just shy of 16,000 individuals, of which 12,000 plus were adults and 3,400 were youth. The graph to the upper right gives you an indication for the past 5 years, and the lighter blue color shows the adult population, and the darker blue color at the bottom shows you the youth population, so you can see that we've been gradually increasing. However, our numbers have remained relatively flat overall. It's also important to note that, as the slide says, that in the last year we served 2,394 clients mutually between the Office of Developmental Disabilities and Vocational Rehabilitation. The other circles on the slide give you a little bit of an insight as to the demographics around the disabilities claimed by the individuals that we serve with our program, as this emphasis on employment first are emphasizing individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's important to note that our program serves a variety of disabilities. So this gives you just an indication on the left-hand side, the percentages of the clients we serve and the demographics of their disability. And then on the circle to the right, a little bit deeper dive into the intellectual and developmental disabilities and diagnosis. Something really quick before I go to the next slide. It's important to notice that even though vocational rehabilitation has had the ability to serve approximately 16,000 individuals, in the state of Oregon, there's over 200,000 Oregonians of working age that are living with day-to-day with a disability. And even the Social Security Administration, when they issue their Ticket to Work program, they've issued over 60,000 Ticket to Work for the state of Oregon, of which 40% of those individuals have indicated to them that they'd like to go to work. Now, those numbers far exceed the capacity, unfortunately, of what we're able to serve. So just bringing that to this attention.
Excuse me, Trina, could you explain that the Ticket to Work, what is that?
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Dimbrough. The Ticket to Work program is a program based from Social Security Administration for those individuals that are currently receiving Social Security disability, and it's the opportunity to participate in a what they call Ticket to Work, an opportunity to get benefits counseling and to be able to participate, and it's a very detailed mathematical equation that I will try not to go dive into too much, but it's an opportunity for individuals to pass through some of their income where they don't necessarily lose all of their Social Security during the period of time that they're trying to go back to work, in a nutshell.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide. So the next slide talks a little bit about the different levels of VR services. And if you'll notice on the right-hand side in the upper right, you'll see a pyramid with four layers. This was a presentation strategy that we did with the Ways and Means Committee. And if necessary, I can blow this up for you. But it talks about four different layers. The bottom layers are actually the services that are provided through the Centers for Independent Living, where individuals come into the local centers all over the state and obtain a lot of different types of services. The funding comes through VR to the centers to be able to provide assistance for independent living skills. The top three layers are the ones, and there's little arrows that show. The basic services is the next layer, which really helps individuals to find and enter and maintain their employment. And so just to give you a point of context, the number of individuals that we served in that layer last year was a little over 12,000 received our basic services. It could include job coaching, behavioral specialists, rehab technology, maybe a modification. There's an example that we utilized. There was a gentleman in Eastern Oregon who needed some modifications to a tractor so he could get in and be able to still utilize a tractor with his disabilities. The biggest thing that is important to understand is that the services are incredibly individualized and wrapped around that the person and what their needs are. So they're going to differ from person to person. Going up the ladder on still in the slide, thank you, is the Youth Transition Program. We served, and by the way, I do have a youth transition person who's a specialist in the audience if we get into some very specific questions, as he can probably speak to it a little bit more than I can. Just a point of context, for last year, we served about 3,500 youth in Oregon. This is ages 16 through 21, and really focusing upon our new pattern of engaging schools earlier, and Mitch is going to talk a little bit about that in just a few moments. There are transitional and specialists in the school districts. Right now, I believe there's about 105 different districts, which equates to about 120 high schools, which is about two-thirds of the state. And this is really our opportunity where we're trying to leverage and sequence the funding between ODDS, education, and VR to wrap it around the individual. Some services that would fall within the youth transition are the soft skill development, some self-advocacy training, career experience, job shadowing, work experience, and accommodations training. The top layer, which is supported employment, is our most intensive services that vocational rehabilitation provides. We served approximately 1,700 individuals last year. And there's three real target populations that receive these services, and individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and severe and persistent mental illness. A couple of examples for services that fall within that realm is additional extra job coaching, on-the-job training, and really standing side by side and helping that individual as they are learning about their job and coping with the stresses and the job duties. Next slide. In addition to the services that vocational rehabilitation provides to our clients, we also have services that we provide to providers and employers. Training, sharing of information and support. We have multiple trainings that we go out into the community to provide that talks about a strength-based model and education enhancing employment outcomes training, EOP2 training, that really helps with our job placement contractors. We have done employment webinars, vocational rehabilitation in service, and different benefits and work incentive training for the providers. Additionally, the services for employers would some of the examples would be live resumes, meeting with the business, tapping fresh talent job fairs, and option conferences. Plus, we provide a variety of consultation and support around disability awareness, the ADA, American Disability Act, 503 compliance, and accommodation and assessment. We found really early on, as we were helping to develop jobs within the community, that it was really important to support the employers and the providers equally as we do our clients to be able to really ensure their success. Okay, next slide. Some of the priorities and challenges for vocational rehabilitation is the implementation of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. There are some major challenges for us. We've moved to what we call a 90-day to plan. Once an individual is determined eligible, we then have 90 days to put them into a plan. Before, our target was 180 days. So effective January of this year, we've sliced that in half. Each plan is individualized, and it doesn't mean necessarily we're going to have a placement in 90 days, but it means that a plan exists, and so a plan can be worked. Additionally, WIO implementations require us to look at our performance metrics in ways that we hadn't looked at. We've always counted the number of individuals coming into our program, the number of placements, and the number of rehabilitations. And now we're going to have to look at second quarter and fourth quarter after the placement to see for longevity. Also have to look at the wage comparison in a different manner and taking a look at employer satisfaction, of which that's not something that we've historically done other than, you know, just meeting with individuals to follow up at the end to determine if people are successful. Additionally, there are WIO is requiring us to do a lot of youth transition services. You may have heard that the pre-employment training supports, there's five required activities around youth. Job exploration and counseling is one of them, work-based learning and experience, counseling on opportunities for the individual, workplace readiness, and instruction on self-advocacy. And the last couple of bullets as well, one of our biggest challenges, obviously, is the increase of the inflow of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities coming into our system. as we have served them in the past, now we have a more greater emphasis, which is not a bad thing by any means. However, you know, as the previous slides show, we serve all disabilities, so it just presents its own host of challenges. Let's see what I got. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Mitch, and I'll scoot back so you can get up here.
I'll just switch.
Okay, I'll do that.
Senator Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Kruska. As I mentioned, I am the Director of Educational Programs for the Oregon Department of Education, and I am the administrator tasked with being the liaison between the department and DHS, ODD, VR, and Employment First. So I'm the individual who sits on a lot of the meetings and has the conversations with these agencies. We wanted to provide you a little background in education and how that fits in with all of this. In education, the services are driven mostly by the Individuals with Disability Education Act, IDEA. It has 12 eligibility categories. If a student is found eligible in one of those categories, they receive specialized individual services. Each individual student has an individualized education plan, which is specifically addresses their needs. Transition services become part of that IEP when the student turns 16 years of age and are in place until the child either graduates or ages out at 21. Transition services are based on a student's post-secondary goals, whatever those goals may be, whether they be employment-related or post-secondary education-related. There are over 86,000 children ages 6 through 21 who are currently served and identified as special education students in the state of Oregon. There are 197 public school districts in the state, but more importantly for this conversation, there are 375 public high schools that provide some form of transition services to students with disabilities. Education is required under the IDEA to provide transition services to all youth with disabilities, and all those services are consistent with the law and are individualized, so we don't single a group out for specific services. All students receive all services. Additionally, under the Executive Order 1501, ODE has been given specific provisions to serve students with IDD. A lot of that work is being done in collaboration with VR and DD to support the delivery of transition services to the students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. One of the requirements under the executive order was to create the Transition Technical Assistance Network, which consists of 8 transition network facilitators who are stationed throughout the state. Each one has a region, and it is their responsibility to act as a liaison between local agencies to bring education, DD, and VR together and to overcome any barriers or obstacles that are in the place. And so far, that has been a tremendously successful program. We provide education and awareness activities to students with IDD and their families around the expectation of employment first and employment in integrated community settings. We anticipate that during the 8-year course of the executive order, approximately 15,000 students will be transition age, will be eligible for DD services. These are students who are identified as special education and meet an eligibility criteria who also qualify for DD services. Priorities and our challenges will, at this point in time, will be the implementation of WIOA and RIOA-related activities. WIOA, the passage of WIOA, has significantly impacted the relationship between VR and education, and so it has increased our conversations significantly in working to coordinate services to meet the requirements of the WIOA. Again, it's our work to expand community-based job experience opportunities for students through collaboration with VR and DD and make those more meaningful, integrated type experiences, whether they be job shadows, job experiences, or actually paid work. Continue the collaborative efforts at the local level among all key partners. And this is key because it's the local level where this work is really being done. The individual transition teacher at the high school working with the local VR and DD office. And that's it.
Senator Dimbro, members of the committee, that's the end of our formal presentation. So, you know, if you have questions, this last slide just tells where some additional information can be obtained. The middle one there is really the one that has the most detailed information around the Employment First Initiative in terms of the success stories, data reports, some of the specific implementation plans we have. That's where you'd go if you really wanted to dive more deeply into kind of the specific initiative.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike, and all of you for really very thorough presentation. I have a quick question about how you go about getting employers to partner in the various programs. You know, what sort of outreach mechanisms are there? What sort of incentives are there for them?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to switch chairs. I'll let me just do this way.
Okay. You just steal
that? I'll start and then you can jump in. Chair Dimbro, again, my name is Trina Lee, and to answer your question, we are working really closely, first of all, with the Employment Department and really strategizing on, you know, how we engage with employers, but also to have them assist us with some of the provider needs and some of the challenges around the capacity that Lilia had talked about earlier. We also have job placement individuals that go in and talk with employers directly, along with our vocational rehabilitation counselors, do the same thing, engage with really having that conversation to, you know, try to have a placement eventually for some of the individuals with disabilities.
Thank you. Chair Dimbro, I would just follow up with that to say that from the ODDS perspective, a lot of the work that is that makes those connections most important is the work that's on the ground, being done on the ground by job coaches and other types of professionals through VR and also through ODDS.
And just to follow up, and are there financial incentives to employers who use workers referred to through VR?
Chair Dimbro, again, in my presentation, there was a couple of small little pictures on the right-hand side, and one is called, the name just escaped me. Let me look at it really quick here. Think Beyond the Label and Staffing Solutions, and those are interactive where you can go onto some websites that will, and they're based upon employers all around the country. So based upon the state that they are in, it will indicate what opportunities may exist with any kind of tax incentives and those kind of things. So there is some information there, and that's one of the things when our counselors go out and also our specialists go out, they have an entire packet of information they give employers as to some of the incentives and whatnot that's available.
Mainly federal incentives, yeah, or a combination of federal and state?
Chair Dimbro, unfortunately, I'm a little new to the chair, and being in my month four, and so I will need to do a little bit of research and get back with you, if you don't mind.
Great, thank you. Any other questions?
I have a quick question about individual supported employment. If I'm understanding correctly, individual supported employment is meant for those who might have multiple issues, you know, for lack of a better term, and they might need to have somebody there with them on the job. And so who would pay for that? Is it the employer or is it the service that?
Yeah, Chair Dimbro, Vice Chair Thatcher, that's an excellent question. The way the individual support employment, or we call it job coaching in our service vernacular, works is that we partner for somebody getting a new job. We partner with vocational rehabilitation, and they go through the vocational rehabilitation process in general. VR connects the person with a job, and they start the job with supports, job coaching supports through vocational rehab. At the point when the case needs to be closed because VR has a time-limited period that they can work with someone. ODDS comes into play, and we provide the similar job coaching supports and services then throughout the time that the person needs them while they maintain the job over an extended period of time, whatever time it is that they need to provide the supports for them while they're on the job. And the supports are, you know, helping them learn the job, potentially helping them do the job, some level of support with activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. So it's a number of different things that the job coach supports the person with once they achieve the job. And I think this is where the partnership between ODDS and VR is important, because VR has specific requirements about ending those supports. And for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, we fully understand that those supports are going to need to go beyond that time period, which is why we work together to identify how, you know, the point at which we come in and provide that support for the person over the longer term.
Can I jump in really quick? Yeah. Senator, yes, Chair Dimbrough and Vice Chair Thatcher, in addition to that, I had mentioned earlier about the layering the services around individuals is exactly what Lily is talking about, where the funding, if a person has been determined eligible for vocational rehabilitation, ends up getting paid for through our services. And then once a placement has happened and a person is stabilized and have been in placement for 90 days, then we do close our services and consider it a rehabilitation. And that's when ODDS picks up the services. What's really vitally important, and you hit on a very key point, is that we want to use some of the same providers, so we have that consistency wrapped around the individuals. So we're going through some common credentialing of those providers, so then they can switch from our system to their system seamlessly. Now, this is easier said than done, but we're working on it.
Yes, Senator Kelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I may, I think one of the key points on this issue goes back to that idea of training and moving towards independence. An individual with an intellectual and developmental disability may be in supported employment, but the idea is that you're developing those skills for that individual so eventually they don't need supported employment services anymore. They'll be working on their own in the community. Perhaps when they change jobs because they want to move up to a different job that suits their interests or a higher level of skill, those supports might come back in. But over time, what the research demonstrates is that in supported employment, individuals with developmental and intellectual and developmental disabilities are more likely to be able to work independently and competitively than in a sheltered workshop, where 95% of the people never move beyond that sheltered place.
But I still didn't get who pays for it. So it's the DHS, the programs there, and that's what you mean by providers.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
And just to follow up a little further, you know, some of the funding is general fund dollars and some is federal dollars, right?
Yeah. For supports provided through the Office of Developmental Disabilities, that's a Medicaid matched program, so our programs are matched federally. And Trina can talk to the VR federal match. One of the important points that has come out of CMS over the past few years is actually at this point at a federal level, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, is the biggest funder of employment supports in the country. It's not employment-specific programs. It is Medicaid programs because of the work like what we're talking about here with people with disabilities over a longer period of time.
And Chair Dimbrough, for vocational rehabilitation, there is a state match to the federal dollars. It's about a 75-25 split. However, vocational rehabilitation, it is a capped grant, and so it's a little bit different than some of the traditional Medicaid programs. We have to work within that cap.
Okay, thank you all very much for this panel. Okay, so I'd like to call up Jamie Daniel. Daniel, Ross Ryan, and Bob Junda, please.
Okay.
Welcome all.
Thank you. You're good. Okay. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Jamie Daniel. I'm the director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. The council represents Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. Our members also include other agencies who receive funding to provide services and supports to this population. The council is federally mandated to assure that people with developmental disabilities have access to services and supports that promote self-determination, independence, and inclusion in all facets of community life, including employment. Our charge is described in the Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act, which asserts that disability is a natural part of the human experience, which in no way interferes with the right of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, to experience all facets of community life, including employment. This includes the right to have a job in the community that pays minimum or prevailing wages and allows someone to contribute to a local business and local economies. We deeply appreciate our state's investment in implementing Employment First policy. The policy presumes that all people with developmental disabilities are capable of working in community jobs where they can earn prevailing wages and contribute to their communities. The belief also applies to people with significant disabilities. The greatest barrier to getting a job isn't disability, it's lack of understanding. And what really helps people get jobs is creativity, technology, and tenacity. People with significant support needs can and do work in Oregon. In fact, we have several video stories of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are working now. And if you happen to go to the Facebook page of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, you'll see a story about Ben, who is a business owner in Eugene, who uses technology to do his job. And I'd be happy to share other stories with you as well, written and in video. We understand that not all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities will choose competitive employment. We urge the state to prioritize day programs provided in the most integrated setting, consistent with federal home and community-based rules and regulations, and that in these settings, people are connected to age-appropriate activities in community according to each person's interests and preferences. We understand Employment First is a process. It takes a long time. It's a transformation. And we expect careful planning to assure that people do not lose their services, that people are fully informed of their choices, and that service providers get the help they need to transform their business models as needed. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities want to work. This is very clear. Oregon's 2013 National Core Indicators data shows that 60% of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities surveyed who don't have a competitive job said they want one. Additionally, self-advocates have been busy working on the issue of employment for at least three decades. In 1986, People First of Oregon published a Bill of Rights in which they said, we have the right to a job in the community. We do not want to live in poverty. We want to work for fair wages. Flash forward 30 years, the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition publicly states that they believe that all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities should have living wage jobs in their communities. Clearly, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities want to work. These demands are consistent with their civil rights and federal laws and an Oregon law, and they're consistent with implementation of Oregon's Employment First policy. Additionally, as Senator Gelser mentioned, Oregon families want their sons and daughters with disabilities to work and participate in community life. This is a growing trend that's happening nationally, but also in Oregon. And as evidence, 2014 Family Network survey data shows that families of young children have high expectations for their kids to go to school, included in general education classrooms, to play on the same playgrounds, to participate in community life, and especially to work. For example, 82% of these parents said they believe that their child will have a paying job. These families want their children with intellectual and developmental disabilities to experience desired outcomes, just like all of us want our children to experience desired outcomes, regardless of disability. Employment First will help our system prepare for current and future generations of people who have high expectations for employment and community life. Let's welcome these people by continuing Employment First and ending the discriminatory practice of some minimum wage for people with developmental disabilities. Oregon is stronger when all members of its communities work, contribute to local economies, and participate in the greater good. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities deserve that we honor this right. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Okay. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Riley Newport, and I'm an advocacy coordinator with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Today, I will be supporting Ross in his testimony by asking questions.
Committee chair and the committees, my name is Ross Ryan, and I'll be speaking on behalf of the OSHA committee on the employment, and we are an 18-member group, which is a statewide group. And we think that we had a bigger voice by creating a statewide group. And I'll be speaking to you on the appointment stuff that we've been working on.
So, Ross, why is it important to have a job in your community?
So we can fit in, and we have the same skills. And we just want to be treated like everybody else and pay our taxes like the rest of the people.
How is the community better when people with disabilities are working in their community?
What was that?
I'll repeat it. How is the community better when people with disabilities are working in their community?
Because we share the same likes, and we all work together as a whole versus trying to separate us, and we have the general interest.
What is your job now?
My job now is a paid advocate through the DD Coalition. And my job is to go to meetings, ask the important questions, and report back to the statewide group, OSAC, and the DD Council on how things are running through the state.
Great. So you shared some information about your job. Would you expand on your duties?
My duties are asking the questions, getting the answers and relaying the information, and also making sure that things are being done correctly.
You worked in a sheltered workshop, and now you work in the community. How is it different?
In a sheltered workshop, we mainly do nothing for a couple of hours, then we work for a few, and we make less than minimum wage, which makes it harder to get what we want out of life.
Talking a little more about sheltered work, some people with disabilities are paid less than minimum wage because they have a disability. What do you think subminimum wage says about how we value people with disabilities?
People value us that we are different. We are like second class. Everybody's up here, and we way down here, and we say we want to be equal like everybody else.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like that we are not wanting to fit in.
So now that you're working in the community, why is minimum wage or better important in your life?
So we can have a roof over our head, and where we can do what we want, and just to have fun, do what everybody else does. So it's nothing without us.
What supports do you need to do your job?
Transportation, spelling, working on my calendar, and making sure that all my notes that are in order depending on the committee.
All right. Although you're already working, why should an employer hire you?
I'm responsible, I'm on time, and I have a passion in what I like to do in my career.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junef. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for inviting me today. I thought it might be best to start by saying that giving you a sense of where policy has gone in the area we're discussing today, because my organization, Disability Rights Oregon, really came into being as a creature of federal policy, because the federal government came up with some money because Congress was very upset about the institutionalization of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and the conditions that they lived under in state institutions around the country. So at that time, and we're talking about back in 1976, some money was provided to each state and territory to provide for some advocacy services for these individuals. And at that time, you might recall that the best practice of the day when a family had a child with disabilities was to suggest to the family that the child be given up to an institution and the family move on without looking back, if you will. People who did go to institutions lived among other people with disabilities, supervised by folks who were paid to look at them. The types of training, skills, education that they needed in order to live in the world were not provided. It was expected that they would live out their days in that institutional setting. And again, in the mid-70s, the thinking started to change. It had been coming forward in the community of people with disabilities, but it started to take hold. And the idea was that institutions weren't working. And with proper education, early identification, training supports that people could live in their communities, they could live with their families, with the proper supports their families could provide that support. And we embarked upon a new process. Part of that was the special education law that you heard about, so that children had a right to be identified at a young age, to determine what educational services that they needed in order to make educational progress and to move forward with their lives. Part of that law also called for what's called transition services, which is the recognition that all children need to be prepared to enter into the next phase of life, which could mean further education, it could mean the job market. Unfortunately, as we started to make progress in that area, we found that having effective transition services and having effective employment opportunities awaiting a person on the other end were very hard to come by. Policy started to move in recognition of that to create more incentives to provide employment opportunities to people. And as part of that, our organization started the shift as well, and we were given more resources to assist people in getting the training and education that they need to be effective in the workforce, as well as to deal with impediments to being able to work. There were other laws put into place, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, that gave individuals with disabilities rights not to be discriminated against in work and in public services. In 1999, there was the Ticket to Work Act that you have been heard about, which also embraced the new way of looking at disability. The old way of looking at disability was that if a person was considered to be disabled, determined to be disabled, that was sort of the end of their work life, and they would never be expected to work again. The Ticket to Work Act recognized that people who experience disability may be able to, in many, many, perhaps most cases, be productive at some level. But there were impediments to doing that, and one of the impediments was having the adequate supports and training, but also there were fears that people experienced that gee, if I go back to work and I fail, or I get laid off, I have other problems, that I will have given up my benefits and then I'm going to be stuck. I won't have my health benefits. I won't have any economic supports. The Ticket to Work Act provides for certain programs and policies that allow people to move their ways gradually into work without risk of losing their benefits. And as they move along and are able to become more productive and more self-sustaining, that should there be a problem in terms of disruption of their work, that they can get back on benefits more quickly and easily. So these are all things that have been moving forward with us for years. Back in, again, at the beginning of the new century, there was a federal Supreme Court case called the Olmstead case that said that folks have a right to receive the most integrated services possible that are not blow the financial wad of the state or the local funders, and allow people to experience life outside of institutional situations and in the community. One thing before I go on, I need to reveal, I guess, or just to acknowledge that our office is one of the representatives of the class of people who are suing the state right now, having to do with access to supported and integrated employment services. And so our view of how those services are being implemented is flavored by that. That case is now, that was filed over 3 years ago, so it's moving its way through the legal system. But one of the premises of that case is that individuals under the Olmstead decision, under the ADA, have a right to choose the employment services in the most integrated setting. The last thing I just wanted to, well, two things I wanted to note, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence, is that the policies that we're talking about in terms of moving people into integrated employment have now become not only institutionalized, but are being driven by federal policy. You've heard it discussed earlier in terms of home and community-based waiver changes. There is a new executive order from the president that sets out a minimum wage for federal contracts. And that executive order specifically says that people with disabilities who had formerly been paid under a sub-minimum wage exception could no longer be paid in that manner. They are entitled to at least minimum wage in the workforce. All of these directions are part of a recognition that that people with disability, that we all benefit if people with disabilities are receiving the services and supports they need to be as successful and independent as possible in the community. Last point is that today you will hear a bill having to do with the qualified rehabilitation service that the state law funds. This is different than all of the Medicaid policy and the executive order that you heard described in such great detail earlier. They're two different things. So they're two different policies that the state is engaged in. So in the QRF area, that area is not specific to folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It covers all disabilities. And it has to do with the use of state funds and state in public contracts and not Medicaid-funded services. And so it gets very complicated, and I have had to learn a lot of these complications. But I think the simple point is that there is a now 40 years of ongoing policy to create systems that allow people to be more independent, more self-sustaining, and less dependent upon public services. And in terms of the QRF area, we're hoping that, that state policy doesn't lag behind federal policy, and that when a person enters into the workforce in an effort to provide them with the training and supports they need to be more productive, that we are not carrying forward a state policy that treats them as with less honor and dignity as any other worker.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all very much for coming forth. Okay, we have one last panel. Anna Keenan-Mudrick, Deb Houston, and Chris Burnett, please. Okay, Anna, did you want to go first?
That would be great. Thank you. Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senator Gelser, Senator Knopp, and Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. My name is Anna Keenan-Mudrick, and I am the Executive Director of Community Access Services. I'm here today representing APSE, the Association of Persons Supporting Employment First. Tara Asai would have loved to have been here, but she is gone right now out of state. Actually, she may be out of the country, I'm trying to recall, but I am here on behalf of her and representing her testimony. Initially, I just want to say thank you so much for your interest in employment for individuals who experience developmental disabilities. It's a really so critical and so impressive that we're all here today to talk to you about all these important systems and issues. One of the things that I'm here to talk about today on behalf of APSE is actually the workforce, and this is, it's appropriate to your committee, the Workforce Development Committee, but about how we can be a more engaged part of the workforce development system overall. So, you know, as you have probably heard, 17.6% of people with disabilities nationally are employed, compared to if only it were the reverse, that would be a different problem, a nice one to have probably, 64% of people without disabilities. So there's a pretty significant gap there, obviously, and I think many of us are pretty aware of that, but how we can engage the workforce development system in helping be a part of closing that gap is awfully critical. And as Oregon's economic outlook improves, things are getting better, this is a wonderful thing, how can we ensure then that the people who we support who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities are also seeing those gains, are also a part of the improvement the workforce is all seeing, that we're also seeing that those same gains, actually more gains. We have a ways to come for those who experience developmental disabilities. As you've been hearing today, the people who we support and who we represent are very capable, very creative, very excited to be a part of their communities, including the workforce. There are many benefits of that I don't need to rehash because you've heard lots of them, and I know that we have taken a lot of time here, so I want to make sure to move on. Again, just the critical importance, and APSE absolutely supports this, of the legislature continuing to support the innovation, the creativity that's going on as far as increasing gain and supported employment, that transition, the services evolution is really important. And then what can the workforce system itself do? How can we, as a system, become more a part, an active partner, really, with workforce development? You're hearing today about how ODDS has really been proactively working with OVRS. I think there's been tremendous gains there, tremendous gains as well in partnering with ODE. Now we're working more collaboratively together, now braiding supports much more effectively, which is tremendous. It's huge. It's so critical. So another missing piece here, I think, that could be very exciting to include is the workforce development system. So with me, I have some very specific recommendations that Tara has brought to the table on behalf of APSE for you to consider. One of these is state and local workforce development boards include community organizations that provide or support competitive and integrated employment. Local workforce development boards join with Employment First teams to ensure that there are sufficient service providers in a local area with expertise in assisting individuals with disabilities with their career and training needs. Local workforce development boards assign a committee that serves as a forum to influence the ability of the workforce system to meet the needs of job seekers with significant disabilities. State and local workforce development boards assure that youth with disabilities are served. We know there's very much a focus on youth, which is wonderful. Making sure, again, to include youth with disabilities is also very critical. Set aside funds from the General Workforce Development Statewide Employment and Training Activities Fund that can be used to improve employment and training activities with programs for individuals with disabilities. And, you know, much of what we have been hearing about and learning about with WIOA, a big raising of the bar overall, but a big part of that is raising the bar on how we support job seekers who experience disabilities in transition, but also the general workforce. And that's really, this could be a beautiful way to help support WIOA, to also support the governor's executive order. So I think just with that, I will do a little closing statement here from Tara, and another lovely quote that is on your document that you have as well, but I love her last sentence, very powerful. By supporting innovation, and welcoming the contributions of individuals with disabilities, employers, and the workforce system can assure that all Oregonians participate in the state's economic recovery. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Just briefly as a point of clarification, because it's come up a couple of times. At the National Council on Disability, we were contacted by some Native communities that pointed out that the Workforce Investment
Innovation
and Opportunity Act, that saying the way that the letters sound like is a very offensive term in some Native languages. So they have asked that we just say the words instead of the...
Thank you, Senator Gelser. I appreciate that.
Thank you for pointing that out, Senator. Yeah, we'll have to figure out another way to say it.
My apologies.
Great. Yes, Chris.
Senator Dembro and chairs, I'm Deborah Houston. I'm the interim CEO for Portland Habilitation Center, which is a QRF. We are represented by three unions and pay union wages and benefits and have around 600 employees. Of those 600 employees, we have 23 individuals that work under the 14C with the subminimum wage. What I'm asking for is that I represent those individuals, and that those individuals' concern is the fact that there would be a work group committee involving taking a look at the transition. They're afraid of the falling between the cracks and being abused, that there should be a work group that looks at the transition of those 23 individuals. And those are the concerns I have, and I encourage you to look at a work group. Overall, we totally agree with employment and wages and being trained, and we find that training and out in the community and unions, people can make a livable wage and have benefits, and we've had that for years and been a strong advocate of that. Most of the individuals that we serve under the 14C have been with us for probably 20 to 30 years. They're in their 50s, and their concern is this has been what their livelihood. They are open to change, but they would like a work group to look at a transition.
Thank you, Deb.
Sure.
Yes, Chris.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Burnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, and I thank you for the opportunity to say a few words here. Your heads must be spinning. It's been a full day of employment of all shapes and kinds and types. And
it spins every day.
So our association includes 49 nonprofit organizations in communities throughout the state, and they are essentially the boots on the ground in helping implement a variety of employment strategies. They, our mission as an association, as a group, is to support and advocate for our members as they work to help individuals with disabilities lead full and inclusive lives. 21 of our members have been qualified or designated as qualified rehabilitation facility providers under the Oregon's Products of Individuals with Disabilities Law. And they support those individuals in the working in QRF contracts with honor and dignity. Some of these same agencies who support individuals in the QRF program are also participating in Employment First and have been awarded transformation grants to expand their capacity to provide community-based services. Or is also working with the Transformation Grant Technical Assistant Contractors to support the effort to expand provider capacity to achieve community employment jobs. Some of the challenge to expanding this capacity is the rates, and I know Director Tennedy at ODDS is very well aware that rates need to be revisited and they need to be reality-based rates. The current rebar rate methodology is based on 2007 data, and as you know, times have changed. Jumping back to the QRF program, we estimate that between 4,000 and 4,500 Oregonians are with a wide range of disabilities, which Bob referred to, are employed through the Products of Individuals with Disabilities Law. But only about 4,500, and granted that's still a big number, work on QRF contracts and are earning productivity-based wages. These are the individuals who are most likely to have to get reduced hours or job loss if a single wage parameter were implemented. I wanted to thank Senator Gelzer, too, for so clearly articulating the difference between a QRF and a sheltered workshop or facility-based employment setting. They serve different populations and have different funding streams. And I also appreciated her comment in hearing the other day that there are no good guys and no bad guys in this. Everyone has the best intent for the individuals that they support. So thank you for that. some individuals employed by the QRF, under QRF contracts, have intellectual and developmental disabilities, but the majority experience mental illness, are returning veterans with disabling injuries, and also have physical disabilities. So I think throughout the testimony today, you've begun to see that these are different populations served with different funding. 70 to 75% of the people receiving services in this program have no long-term funding should they lose their job. They are not individuals with developmental disabilities that are covered under Employment First or the governor's executive order related to community integration. However, these, as I said, may be the individuals who are most likely to experience job loss or reduced hours. So given the context of the various populations we've been talking about impacted by the decisions that you might make here regarding passing bills, I want to emphasize a few key points. I don't want you to leave here thinking that somehow people are held hostage to work in a setting against their will. The door is wide open to anybody who seeks other employment options at whatever level is appropriate to their needs based on their informed individual choice. Oregon has significantly increased the resources available to community support, so anyone who wants a community job should not face a barrier. Oregon has long held and retains a national leadership role in progressive supports that are person-centered for both residential supports and employment supports compared to other states and continues to make progress in that area. I would encourage us not to move from a person-centered process to a policy-centered process, and that it is still based on the individual's definition of what is a meaningful day or what is meaningful work to them. Our advocacy is for maximum work and the maximum wage based on the needs and desires of the individual. We applaud those parts of the governor's executive order that promote informed choice and provide resources to individuals to live out their choices. The result of closing all facility-based employment in other states is mixed, but in Vermont in particular, 36% of the individuals who previously worked in facility-based settings found jobs in the open market. In Maine, it was about 23%. And that was about an average of 10 hours of work per week. I've made a lot of notes as I listened to other testimony. And, you know, there was discussion about, you know, what is prioritized. And unfortunately, you know, the rates are prioritizing, not unfortunately, but the rates prioritize community employment, as they should, but the the rates for serving sometimes very significantly disabled individuals have been greatly reduced, so it increases the challenge for the community providers as they provide those services. That is probably the extent of my comments, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you very much, Chris. Any questions for the... Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. And first of all, I just wanted to thank you and all of the organizations. I know there's a philosophical difference here, but these are organizations that have worked really hard for a long time and continue to for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and we wouldn't have been able to move to the strong community-based system that we have without the support of all these folks. I did have a question. I kind of saw in the testimony the Vermont number and looked that up because it was different than the data that NCD had gotten, and I think there was an error in that Kansas City Star. Yeah. There, that 38% number is actually the rate of people with developmental disabilities that are in supported employment, but 80% in Vermont of the people that were in the sheltered workshops were then employed. Not all full-time, but 38% is the percentage of people with IDDD that are in integrated employment, which is double the national average, according to their state's data.
Oh, if the data is wrong, I stand corrected. But
well, no, and that article was there. I think that there was an error in the Kansas City Star, and I think they just grabbed that 38% number of that total.
Okay.
I don't know about Maine, though.
Okay.
Okay, panel, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the information hearing, and I'm going to open a work session now on Senate Bill 468, please. Matt, remind us, we heard this one a few weeks ago.
We did. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, Senate Bill 468 authorizes the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries to issue warrants for debts not paid within 30 days of the due date. It requires warrants issued by the department to include the principal amount of the debt, any interest and other costs, and must be filed with the clerk of the county of any county in the state and must be mailed to the debtor at the debtor's last known address. There is an amendment for this bill. It's a -1 amendment. Forgive me as I bring it up here quickly. The -1 amendment requires the entry of judgment and expiration of time period for notice of appeal before the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries can issue warrants. There's a minimal fiscal impact for both the original bill and the amendment.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated March 12, 2015.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum moves the -1 amendments dated March 12, 2015. And colleagues, you may remember from the hearing there was some concern about what would happen if there was an appeal of the case, and would garnishing happen while that was in process. And so the -1 amendments just clarifies that's not the intent, that if warrants were to be served, it wouldn't be until after the entire legal process was completed. And that seemed to solve the major concern. Are there any discussion of the amendments? I hear none. Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, the objections are amended. No, the amendments are adopted. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 468 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 468 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the measure? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the amendments, and I will be a no in committee only from the standpoint that I haven't had time to talk to a couple of small businesses from my district that were concerned about the original bill. I'm hoping that the amendment allays their fears, and that I can be a yes on the floor, but I'll be a no in committee today.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a yes in committee, and for the same reason, I might be a no on the floor. But I do appreciate the amendment and the thought that just to make sure that a judgment is going to be entered before payment will be pursued, and I think this is not a bad idea. So with that, I'll be supporting it in committee.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Yes.
And Chair Denver?
Yes. Okay, the motion passes. And Senator Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum will carry. Okay, I'm going to close this work session and open our public hearing on Senate Bill 555. And colleagues, because of the time pressure, we are again going to move the last panel and a half on the apprenticeship bill that we heard last Wednesday. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Dimbro, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8. Senate Bill 555 is a little piece of what we were talking about. It is actually a very narrow proposal. And when I listen to testimony like Ross's, it makes me wish that we could do more faster. I think when Ross talks about being valued and being equal, the pressure to me feels pretty strong. That was pretty powerful testimony. However, I recognize that we need to have a process. And Senate Bill 555 offers us that first step. It does one thing. It says that when a public agency contracts with a QRF to purchase goods or services, that that public agency must ensure that anybody providing goods and services for the public is paid at least minimum wage. As legislature, as governments, we set a minimum wage. We should hold ourselves to paying the minimum wage for the goods and services from which we benefit. The way that this would work is that the burden of that increased cost of those increased wages would fall on the public entities that are contracting with the QRFs. That would be kind of moving forward in future contracts. It would not impact contracts with non-public entities. It would not close any sheltered workshop. It would not require that minimum wage be paid to everyone on every contract, just on those contracts that the public is benefiting for, such as the ODOT vests or mowing at a school district. People working for the public should earn at least minimum wage, very similar to the executive order at the federal level. Happy to answer any questions. And I want to emphasize again, nothing in this, because I've received some emails, closes sheltered workshops. It actually doesn't change anything about sheltered workshops. It's just about QRF contracts with public entities, and we pay, not the nonprofits.
Any questions of the senator? Okay, thank you. We have a bunch of people who have signed up. So if you would come up. Charles Edelson, and we've got a lot of people from Shangri-La. Oh, okay. Well, let's bring up Tim Rosak.
Close enough.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay, why don't you two go first?
Why don't you go first, Tim?
Let's switch so I can get to the mic.
Thanks. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. For the record, my name is Tim Rochak, and I've been called way worse. And I'm used to the mispronunciations. Thank you for trying. I appreciate that. For the record, I am the CEO of Garten Services. We have three branches here in Salem, Oregon. We have a branch in Dallas, Oregon, and we have a branch in Eugene, Oregon as well. We serve approximately 500 people with disabilities each year, and we are a vocational-only program. We don't provide residential services. I'm here to speak about Senate Bill 555. First, I want to thank and applaud Senator Gelser's efforts to further the civil rights movement for people with disabilities. I deeply appreciate her passion and her advocacy. As someone who has spent 34 years of my own life advocating for and creating jobs for people with disabilities, I can really appreciate what you're trying to do with this bill, so thank you for that. Also, the testimony about employment first juxtaposed against this is a little concerning to me. So I want to just be clear to say that while I have some concerns about 555, I don't have concerns about trying to get community jobs for people with disabilities. I was on the task force that formed the Employment First policy. In the last 28 years of my career, I've been working on converting sheltered workshops to community integrated employment and more normal employment for folks with disabilities. Having said that, I can't speak out against a bill that would increase earnings for people with disabilities. However, make no mistake, this bill will not do that. This bill will cause people to lose their jobs. This bill actually increases earnings for a select group of people with disabilities that are people who function at a higher level. Most of those folks in programs like Garten and other programs are already working at minimum wage or better jobs. It's not my concern for those folks, and we are, as an example, Garten is converting our services to more community-integrated employment. We are one of the recipients of a state transformation grant, and in my past career, the state actually has hired me as a consultant to go around and teach other people how to change over to more community-integrated employment. I'm fully in favor of that. However, eliminating productivity-based employment as a tool is going to hurt people with the most significant disabilities. It's going to cause them to lose their jobs and, in many cases, the opportunity to work altogether. Most of these individuals are not earning their, most of these individuals are not using their earnings to cover their full living expenses. Because of the severity of their disabilities, most of these individuals that I'm concerned about live in group homes, foster homes, or other 24-hour support situations. In some cases, we serve people who live in state-run group homes because of the severity of their disabilities. I had testimony that I submitted. I don't know if you have a picture of Francis there in front of you. If you don't, may I?
Yeah, we probably
can give it to Carrie, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I want to say real clearly that I believe that anybody with a disability can work in a community job, given sufficient resources and given sufficient time. Even Frances, I believe, could probably work in a community job if we had enough time and she had the desire. I want to point out Frances because she's somebody that's near and dear to our heart. Frances, like a lot of folks born in the 40s, was somebody that was not thought to live after she was born prematurely. And she was born at a weight of 2 pounds 9 ounces with significant birth injuries. She wasn't given much of a chance of surviving. She eventually was institutionalized at Fairview, as a lot of folks of that era were. And she wasn't given much chance of leaving Fairview, but leave Fairview she did. If you knew Frances, she's a spitfire. You should get to know Frances as I have, because Frances advocates for herself very clearly. She came out of Fairview and went to work at Garten in 1972. By the way, Garten was founded in 1970, so she's been there most of the time we've existed.
And Tim, if you could wrap up.
Sure. The point I want to make about Frances is Frances says adamantly, I'm not leaving here. I want to work as long as I can. I'm going to work here forever. This bill would force us to consider laying Frances off and people like Frances. It would break her heart to be told that she can't work at Garten anymore, even if we think she could work at a competitive wage in the community. The 3 points I want to close with, it might be said that the state would simply increase the prices or increase the revenue to cover the cost of paying people with disabilities on state contracts minimum wage, regardless of their productivity. Even if that were true, state agencies will find a way to avoid paying higher costs. It's going to hurt that program. It's going to decrease jobs for people with disabilities if we have to raise prices as a result of offsetting the productivity. Public entities actually contract with half of the QRF program, so even if we could get the state agencies to comply and honor the law and allow QRFs to recover their full cost, the other public entities make up about 50% of the QRF program. That's cities, counties, other political subdivisions like universities. Those subdivisions, the state does not have authority to enforce the QRF law, and those entities are under budget pressures, as I'm sure you're aware, and those entities will look for ways to avoid the QRF law, which will lead to job loss for people with the most severe disabilities. And then finally, I want to just address, if we don't do this, what then? I've already told you that I'm an advocate for people with disabilities, and so I wanted to have at least something for you. This bill, I think, is going to cause unintended harm to people I care about and I'm responsible to support. My answer to, if not this, then what? There is plenty of momentum, as you heard in the presentation early this morning, with the Employment First Initiative, with the governor's executive order, with the lawsuit. We're going there anyway. Our organization and organizations like Garten around the state are changing over to provide community integrated employment at minimum wage and better. It's going to happen without this bill. This bill just adds extra chaos and extra things to figure out while we're trying to go to that good place. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Rochak. Mr. Edelson.
Thank you, Chairman Dembro, members of the committee. I work at Co-Opportunity, which compared to Garten is an extremely tiny employment program based in Albany. And the way I see this bill operating is it would say to the state agency, look, we're going to modify the contract to, and I don't know if you folks have ever seen a QRF contract, but some very detailed calculations that go into it, inputs for labor costs, equipment, transportation, just about overhead, almost anything you can think of. So this bill is going to modify the price on a given contract by bumping up the labor contribution so that everything's calculated at minimum wage. That price is then going to be paid to the provider agency, such as ours or TIMS. And so it's on its face, it's revenue neutral to the provider.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment? Can you please say your name for the record?
Charles Edelson, E-D-E-L-S-O-N, from Co-Opportunity in Albany. Great. Anyway, we see this as, on its face, revenue neutral to our agency because we would pay more to our clients, but we would receive more in contract payments for the services we provide. The difficulty we see, as Tim alluded to, is when we've had prior negotiations with state or local agencies, they're very sensitive to the price that we charge for the service that they're receiving. And they're rather creative. We've had a number of cases where what happens is costs are going up, and so what the agency says is, okay, look, let's pare back the service level until we reach this number, which we're willing to pay. And so we figure that out. Contract price remains the same, services reduce. The other alternative, just so you know, and we've seen this more on the local level than with state agencies, but they can say, look, we don't like this. It's not going to work out to our benefit. So instead, we're going to have our own employees provide the same service. In our case, it's janitorial service, but if they have their own employees provide it, they pay them as employees, and they're no longer obligated to comply with the QRF law because they're not putting it out to outside vendors of any kind. The QRF law is a preference that says once you go outside, you've got to look to the disabled community first. I don't really know how this would shake out. It would be up to the state agencies and to some extent the localities how they want to make these compensations, but it's definitely an economic distortion for them. Something you might consider, if there's a political will for it, is funding this distortion. You might create something of a statewide equity fund and then allow the agencies to come to the fund and say, look, we had to pay out an extra $40,000 this year on account of this change in the contracts. We want to get reimbursed. And that way, you're getting the money to the people you want to get it to, but you're not causing some of the other difficulties.
Thank you. Yes.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. So this is a question for you, and I've heard the argument before about individuals with disabilities who live in group homes or foster homes don't need minimum wage because they're receiving supports. But there are other people that receive public supports that are entitled to minimum wage, people that are on TANF or receiving employment-related daycare. Should we also take non-disabled people that are receiving public benefits and drop their wages to less than minimum wage?
Senator Gelser, Chair Dembro, thank you for your question. No, that's not what I suggest. My concern is that it's not so much about self-supporting. People like Francis aren't hung up on how much the amount is. Francis is really dedicated to working, and the self-esteem that she gains from being a part of the workforce and the social contact and the interaction and the physical well-being she gets from that. So the amount of money that she makes is less significant. The point that I was trying to get to is we're going to be faced with a tough choice. We could help a Frances. We could go, it's so impactful to her, we're going to go ahead and subsidize the fact that Frances isn't producing enough to offset that wage. But we can't do 50 Franceses.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Arleson, Mr.
Thank you,
Roshek.
Chair. Thank you.
I wonder if everyone from Shangri-La could come up at the same time. Thank you. Welcome all. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, but people like to talk around here. We have like 5 minutes.
Okay. Chairman Dembrough and members of the committee, my name is Helen Honey. I'm the CFO of Shangri-La. I've been there 27 years. I just want to start by saying, as many others have said, Shangri-La is among many providers who support and are working hard towards the Employment First Initiative, which is more possible due to resources provided by the state. My testimony today is not intended to oppose community employment, but to focus on Senate Bill 555 and its immediate financial and human impact to people with disabilities who are currently working. Let's see. Shangri-La has been providing supports to people with IDD for about 50 years in the Salem area. We currently employ 110 people, 40 of whom work on grounds maintenance, janitorial services, and sewing contracts for safety items in the Willamette Valley and along the coast through a QRF program. So 40 out of our 110 are in the QRF program. The remaining 70 people work in wood shops, food service, and for private commercial customers. While Senate Bill 555 applies to all QRF programs that employ people with a variety of disabilities, Shangri-La's experience and testimony only applies to our 110 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. SB 555 requires paying minimum wage to all of our workers in a QRF program. Of the 40 people, if we paid minimum wage, we would have to increase the wages by approximately 115%, which equals about $150,000 for the year. That's just us, which would then be expected to be passed along to public entities that fall within the QRF program, such as cities, counties, Oregon Department of Transportation, Department of Corrections, and local police departments. My concern is that not all public entities have the budget to absorb this additional cost, which might mean that our QRF contracts and the underlying jobs for 40 people to fulfill them would be in jeopardy. The 70 people that don't work on QRF contracts, when I read the bill, it was confusing whether once you're a QRF, the minimum wage requirement applies to everyone. So we have another 70 people that work in a wood shop or in food service, and we would have to pass along about $160,000 a year to our commercial customers. And I don't think, while they support our mission, I don't think that they have the means to do that for us. So I'm afraid for those 70 people in those jobs and those contracts. I'm asking this committee to please research and be aware of the full financial and human impact of this bill on people with disabilities who value their jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll jump right in.
You have like 1 minute.
Okay. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Terry Marsh. I'm the Employment Services Director for Shangri-La. You know that Shangri-La employs people with disabilities in a number of different businesses that Helen talked about. We also support people in actively pursuing, obtaining, and retaining competitive integrated employment. We're also one of the providers that received a transformation project grant. We want people to have competitive community jobs, and that's our primary focus. That's where we're moving towards. And over the years, we've participated in working very closely with VR, who you heard from today, as well as our counties and state, in working towards optimum employment opportunities for people with IDD. We originally designed our businesses as training opportunities. We never really designed them for long-term employment, although many people that work for us, that we support in these businesses, have worked at the same job for years, and some of them will testify today. We also have many people who have gone on to competitive integrated employment based on the training that they received, and they received that training at the pace that they needed and that they requested. We also do hold a 14C certificate, which allows us to pay people a commensurate wage. And there are very strict Department of Labor regulations as well as the way that we determine those wages. There's really a lot of forces at work right now to promote competitive integrated employment. Our Employment First policy that you heard a lot about, the governor's executive order, and the recent changes in our service payments. So right now, everybody's in support of moving forward. And in this time of change, it's the capacity within the state to provide the individualized services that's required. It's not there. We're all working towards it. We're participating in training. We're building capacity. We're doing it. But we're not there yet. So I'd like you to consider the impact of this bill on the current employees of QRFs. It's important that people have choices and they're not left behind in our hurry to make sure that everyone makes minimum wage or prevailing wage right now.
Okay, thank you very much.
My name is Karen Rutledge. I'm the CEO for Shangri-La. I'm here to support Melissa, Brett, and Matt to have some time to tell you about their jobs. Melissa, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, Karen.
Hi, my name is Melissa, and I work at Garden. I worked at, I'm working at ARC Manufacturing. I worked there for 2 years, and I'm making vests for ODOT, and I'm also making vests for City of Salem. As you can tell, I'm all covered with thread. So if you see a little orange threads around, then you can tell I've been here. I don't want to lose my job. You know, I work really hard, and I love my job. If you decide to take that away from me, my coworkers, I wouldn't have nothing to do. I mean, I feel really bad.
Thank you, Melissa. I just want to clarify that the range of productivity of workers in ARC manufacturing is 30% to 50% of industry standards. So while I don't know what Melissa's rate is, that's what she's talking about here for her friends.
Brett, do you
want to
go?
Thank you. My name is Brett Mimis. I came to work at Zerwa City Shop Upper Art School, I3. I was the Google and I stuck wood for the nail gun. If I didn't work the area more, I will feel bad. Something will move out by my mom and dad into my only place, and maybe get a community job, but right now I can't to stay. I am pleased to not living that world, but for me out of a job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brett.
Hello, my name is Matt Duckwall. I work at Shangri-La Cherry City Woodshop. I've worked there for 10 years. I stack the wood onto the conveyor belt and offload particle board to the rip saw.
My last paycheck was $241. And last month, it was $358. I work very hard. I love my job. I love my morning guys on the crew and my supervisor, Jim Schroll. I get up every morning excited about work. I'm afraid if this passes that I might lose my job or that people who I work for might lose their job. If I didn't have this job, I don't know what I'd do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who told you all that you might lose your jobs if your wages increase?
Senator Gelser, my understanding of the law...
it was actually a question for the individuals.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who told you you might lose your job?
They might cut out our services from our work sites. And if that's the case, and if you did, my boss would have to hand out pink cards, and I don't want to lose my job. I enjoy my job, and
your boss told you that?
No, not my boss, but, you know, it's...
Well, let me just jump in and say that I know, you know, whatever comes out of this, our goal is to make sure that everyone has access to good jobs. We really appreciate that you're working, and I can tell that you're all good workers. And, you know, we just want to make sure that as many Oregonians as possible get good jobs and are able to go to work and are able to have the kind of self-esteem that a good job gives you. So we really appreciate your coming forward and meeting with us today. So we do actually have time for one more. We have one more person. The committee after us has moved, colleagues. So we can take this one last piece of testimony. Yes, Lisa Higgins, please. Get it on the record and close this public hearing. You're all that's keeping me here from my other committee, Felisa. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Felisa Higgins, I'm the political director of SEIU Local 49, and I want to first apologize for keeping you from hearings, and secondly apologize for having a cough drop, but I was told I wouldn't be testifying until tomorrow. So SEIU 49 represents about 600 workers at a qualified rehabilitation facility, 600 out of 4,000 in the state. So over the last 11 years as the political director, we've been working diligently with these workers to look at the qualified rehabilitation facilities law. Our workers are in a labor union, so they're substantially different than the other workers that you've heard here before you. We'll have some of them in the building tomorrow talking about this issue. We strongly support Senate Bill 555. In fact, we have recommendations to address some of the concerns raised to make the bill even stronger. We believe that the minimum wage is called the minimum wage for a reason, and that piecework is actually illegal for other workers, and so we don't support piecework for this population or any population in the state, and we do feel it's discriminatory not to pay people the minimum wage, regardless of their ability. To address the issue of layoffs that I believe some of the employers who testified have been concerned about and are threatening because of the increase in wages, we have a bill on the House side that we're working diligently on about that includes retention, and we'd like to see that included in this bill as well. When it comes to the issue of the minimum wage, I just can't stress enough that this is it's called the minimum wage. I want to make sure that that's on the record many times, and that these Qualified rehabilitation facilities receive no bid contracts. And in fact, after working with many local governments, most local governments don't even issue an RFP for services. They actually go directly to qualified rehabilitation facilities and choose one. They just choose one. And then work through the scope of the project with that QRF directly. There was a gentleman up here earlier who talked about the issue of cost versus service. It's a huge issue in the janitorial market. We also represent 2,500 other what we call property services contractor or workers. So they do commercial office space, cleaning, window washing, securing. This is always an issue when you look at costs when it comes to property services contracts. You look at the scope of the project, you determine the cost of the contract, and then there's always flexibility or what we call level of cleaning, depending on how much cost you have to pay. I'd also like to point out that there are many local governments now who contract with Portland Rehabilitation Center who pay prevailing wage. And in fact, substantially above the minimum wage. Our janitors make $13 an hour, including health care for themselves and their children, with no premium cost sharing, given that they're low income and very good copays, plus a retirement package. And like I said, that's 600 out of the 4,000. So I really want to stress that this is doable. We feel like Senate Bill 555 is the first step in making that possible. And we look forward to talking with you further about how you can go even further than this to ensure workforce retention and other important things, including enforcement of wage and hour laws with this community. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Felisa. I would just say for the record that my understanding is that piecework is allowable in this state, but it needs to be compensated at least a minimum wage. Questions? Thank you very much. Lisa.
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting. Okay, colleagues, with that, I will close this public hearing on Senate Bill 555. Thank you for sticking with it. We are adjourned.